April 2nd. Your job is to make fast transitions. The leadership coach Randall Stutman, who has worked with nearly every major hedge fund and CEO on Wall Street, talks about what it means to be a leader at home. Your job as a leader is to make really fast transitions, he says. You play many different roles in many different places. Your job is not to carry the last conversation. If that means you need to settle yourself and sit out in your car for a couple minutes before you walk in the house so you can now be dad, then that's what you need to do. But your job is not to walk into that house and carry with you anything that came from before. You can't let a bad day or a bad person prevent you from being a good parent. You can't bring your garbage from the office into your home. You must keep a clean house, free of the detritus of adult responsibility that your kids couldn't possibly understand. You must leave that stuff outside, and you must do it quickly in the space between leaving work and walking into your home. April 3rd. Again, which will it be?
Anger always outlasts hurt. Best to take the opposite course. Would anyone think it normal to return a kick to a mule or a bite to a dog? Seneca.
Arthur Ashe's time with his daughter was tragically cut short. At the end of his memoir, as he lay dying, knowing how little time he had left, he wrote some advice to her. "We are being watched by our ancestors as I am watching you," he told her. "We possess more than they ever dreamed of having, so we must never let them down." We are watched by our ancestors, yes, but we are also, as Bruce Springsteen put it, haunted by their ghosts. Which will you be for your child? Are you the kind of example they need? Have you left behind the kind of legacy that will protect them, will guide them, that will inspire them to be decent and disciplined, great and good, as Arthur did for his young daughter? Or will you haunt them with your mistakes, with the pain you inflicted on them, with the things left unsaid or unresolved? April 4th. You're too old to act out.
Being silly is still allowed, not excluded by adulthood. What's excluded by adulthood is thoughtlessness. So be thoughtful and silly. Hank Green.
We have all sorts of rules of thumb for when various behaviors are age appropriate. The age they should stop having accidents. The age they should stop throwing tantrums because they're tired. The age it stops being okay for other people to have to pick up after them. And then when our kids mess up, we say, "Aren't you a little old to act this way? Grow up." Unfortunately, we apply this standard far less often to ourselves. Whether it's as serious as an affair or as silly as getting hangry because we neglected to eat, we seem to forget that we should be policing ourselves first. Our kids are at least still kids, even when they're acting a bit beneath their age. You're an adult. What excuse do you have? Remind yourself today and every day that you are getting older, that it's time to grow out of these silly habits that you've lazily allowed yourself to fall into. Remind yourself that you are too old to act out, to stoop this low, to not be responsible for yourself. And remember, your kids are always watching, so act like the adult that they believe you are. April 5th. Don't forget how small they are.
The world would be a terrible place without children, who bring with them innocence and the hope of man's further perfection. John Ruskin.
There's a wrenching scene in the haunting novel The Sweet Hereafter. A widowed husband is folding up the clothes of his late wife. He's struck holding her things by just how physically small she was. This tiny person he loved and misses, she took up so much space in his heart, occupied so much of his waking thoughts, that he came to see her as much bigger than she really was. This is true for our kids, too. They take up so much space in our lives. They have such big presences. They are so loud. So we can easily forget that they are tiny tiny people. They barely have control of themselves. They are dwarfed by us physically, by our experiences, by our confidence in the way things will go. We have to be careful. Whether they are teenagers or toddlers, we can't forget how small they are. When they fall asleep in the car and you carry them to bed, take a second to notice their size. As you pack up their stuff to take them to college, just take a look at how little stuff they have, because their life is still so new. The smaller you realize your kids are, the kinder you will be, the more protective and patient you will be, the more you will appreciate how hard they are trying to figure things out themselves, their relationships, the world. They are so tiny. Do not forget it. April 6th. Are you using this power?
Between stimulus and response, there is space. In that space is our power to choose our response. Viktor Frankl.
In her book, Bringing Up Bebe, the author Pamela Druckerman talks about the pause as the secret to French parenting. Druckerman describes it in the context of sleep training. But the pause can actually be a great strategy for parents in all facets of their kids' lives. When your son trips and falls, do you need to rush over? Or can you pause and let him figure out how hurt he is first, whether he wants or needs to cry? When your daughter comes over and tries to tell you something, do you have to complete her sentences? Or can you pause and let her struggle to find the words and work through what she is trying to say? When your teenager announces that they are quitting the basketball team, do you have to start arguing right away? Can you pause and listen to their reasons and what they want to do instead? When your kid is home from college and scratches the car while borrowing it for the weekend, what if you didn't get upset? Can you pause and consider that it was almost certainly not intentional? As parents, we have to choose our responses wisely, not reflexively. We have to suspend judgment, listen, and think things over. We have to practice the pause so that our kids never have to stop and think about whether they will come to us with their problems, their questions, their hopes, and their dreams. April 7th. You have to move on.
Let the dead past bury its dead. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow.
Remember that time when you really needed your dad and he wasn't there? Because he had his own emotional issues, because he worked too much, because he was an alcoholic? Remember how your mother's overweening affection made you feel smothered and small? Remember how her strictness kept you from enjoying the things that children should get to enjoy? Remember her jealousy or her pettiness or her mood swings? Remember how their self-absorption seemed to make everything, including the things you really needed help with, about them? Of course you remember. How could you not? These were defining experiences. They hurt so much. Now you're angry, as you should be. They had a job they were supposed to do, and they didn't do it. Not well, anyway. And you, the innocent child, suffered for this. You carry the wounds of their failure. But here's the thing. You have to move on. As justified as your anger is, as ongoing as these behaviors may still be with your parents, you have to get beyond it, because now you have children of your own, and they deserve a parent who is there, not one who is clinging to the past, not one who is putting his or her baggage on their shoulders. It will not be easy moving on. No one said it will be. You'll have to process it. You'll have to go to therapy or read books or find a support group. You'll have to sit alone with your thoughts. You'll have to forgive or cut people out of your life. As they say, your problems might not be your fault, but they are your responsibility. And it's your responsibility to move on. Your kids need you to. You need to. April 8th. To have a more peaceful home, have fewer of these. These things are not asking to be judged by you. Leave them alone. Marcus Aurelius. At the core of most of the conflict between parents and children, and so often spouses, it's one thing: judgment. We have opinions and They have opinions, and those opinions are the source of disagreement. If we as parents would like to have a better relationship with our children, there's one simple thing we can do. We can have fewer opinions. Do you really need to have an opinion on what kind of food is served at your daughter's wedding, even if you are paying for it? Do you need to have an opinion on the way they do their hair? Their friends are their friends. What does it matter what you think of them or their parents? So what if they like music that sounds weird to you? So what if they want to raise their kids a different way? Few things in life are better off with your judgment hovering over them. Your family, most of all. April 9th, leave it at the door. All day at work, you experience stress. You witness other people's stupidity. You are the victim of moods and emotions. Your phone pings constantly with alarming news of the world, the pangs and envies that drive social media. What are you to do? Much in the same way that politics are supposed to stop at the water's edge, so must the stress of the world stop at the threshold of your front door. You can't bring that crap home with you. You definitely can't have it running on CNN in the background while you eat dinner as a family. As Randall Stutman said, you need to make that fast transition from frustrated professional to fully present parent so that your home remains a safe place that you are the protector of. Not the protector in the sense of a warrior, but closer to the role of a bouncer. No, sorry, you're not on the guest list. You have to be Teflon. Your boss's temper can't be allowed to stick to you. The contagion of panic or divisiveness should not be tracked into the living room on the bottom of your shoes. You must keep a clean house. You must turn these things away. When you arrive home, be ready to be present, ready to have fun, ready to be the parent they need, not the one that's left over after the ravages of the day. April 10th, embrace this mindset. In Tibet, Buddhist monks make beautiful mandalas out of sand. They spend hours, even days, crafting these complex geometric designs, only to wipe them clean and start over as soon as they're finished. Isn't that a way that we might see all the work we do as parents? You clean, then the house is dirty. You do the dishes, then 5 minutes later, the sink is full again. Literally, before you've even finished helping your kids put their toys away, the toys are splayed out across the floor. The new clothes you just bought them, now they're filthy and frayed. This can drive you nuts if you let it, can piss you off, or you can learn to love it. You can learn to see it like a mandala, an unending ephemeral process that we begin again and again and again and again. You can learn to see it not as work you are doing, but as art. Finished. To be finished would mean the end of this, the end of their childhood, the end of our lives together. No, we like that it's a little bit like Groundhog's Day. We love that it means a chance to wake up and do this with them again, to do it beautifully, to do it well, to do it together. April 11th. Don't be mad at good people.
Speak when you are angry, and you will make the best speech you will ever regret. Ambrose Bierce.
When you lose your temper, who does it inevitably seem to be with? Your family. It's so strange. We'll stomach some pretty rude behavior from strangers on the street, but God forbid your son leaves his shoes out. You're a professional while asking your assistant for the 1,000th time to do something, but you'll get short with your spouse because they couldn't hear you over the noise in the other room. It feels like a paradox, but really, this is a problem of proximity. Precisely because they're closest with you, you have more opportunities to get upset with them than anyone else. And it's a sad, twisted state of affairs. The people who are all bad but far away are rarely targets for our rage, but the people who are mostly good, who on the whole have helped us and loved us many more times than they have hurt us, they're the ones who get the brunt of it. Let's not be angry with good people, Seneca writes in his essay on anger. Today, when you find yourself getting upset with someone you love, remind yourself that their positive traits outweigh whatever is bothering you in the moment. Remind yourself that yelling doesn't make them hear you better. Remind yourself that they probably know they messed up and are already feeling bad enough. Remind yourself how small they are. Remind yourself how good they are. The fact that we can get mad at someone because they love us enough to put up with it, because they're kids, they just have to live with it and us, is not an excuse. We should try not to get upset with anyone, but if we're gonna get mad, let's make sure the object of our frustration is a target of offense, not of opportunity. April 12th. What kind of energy are you bringing? The ubiquity of the word energy these days is probably a sign of how persuasive pseudoscience and charlatans have become in our culture. We are inundated with energy healers and energy crystals. You can hire consultants to analyze your company's energy. You can take a sound bath to remove negative energy or have an aura reader interpret the energy you put out into the world. The amount of sage that has been burned in apartments after breakups rivals the amount of sage that's been used in restaurant dishes. Yet for all this nonsense, energy is a real thing in parenting. Just as Cesar Millan talks about projecting the right energy to your dog, so too can your kids pick up on the energy emanating from you. A bad day at work, they can feel it. Hate where you live, they can feel it. Pissed off at your spouse, they can feel it. They can tell even if you argue only when they're asleep. Why are your kids running around like crazy, acting like monsters today? Well, maybe you ought to check what kind of energy you're generating. Why is your son hitting his little brother? Maybe because you're a ball of tension and frustration, and it's contagious. Why is your daughter being such a terror? Maybe that resentment your wife is holding on to has something to do with it. Maybe your daughter just couldn't stand how things were at breakfast this morning, how awkward and weird it was. When you see behavior and attitude problems, adjust your energy. Look in the mirror first. If you want a happy home, a home with kindness and love and peace, then bring that energy with you. Project it consciously and deliberately. Show that things are good with you and they will be better with everyone else. April 13th. This is their language. The primary language of children is behavior, not words. If you want to know what they're thinking or how they're feeling, watch what they do, not what they say. When we say that actions speak louder than words, this is what we mean. The younger your kids are, the more likely they are to speak entirely with actions instead of words. And this is for one simple and undeniable reason. They don't have the words yet. But even if they did, kids don't understand their feelings, the physical ones or the emotional ones. They don't understand them enough to know how to put words to them. Quite often, they don't even know that they're having feelings. Watch an 18-month-old with an earache. There are no words. There's only discomfort and pawing at the side of their head or waking up in the middle of the night screaming. Watch an 8-year-old with anxiety. There are no words. There are only stomach aches and panic and wet beds. A teenager who has been hurt by someone may in turn hurt others. This is why we need to listen to our kids in more ways than just the obvious literal way. We have to watch them. We have to be patient. We have to understand that a screaming tantrum about the iPad is almost certainly not about the iPad. We have to understand that lethargy and sliding grades are statements. They are symptoms. It is your child speaking to you through behavior. Will you hear them? Will you be able to talk to them about it, not just with your words, but with your own actions? April 14th. It's the hardest thing. Chesty Puller fought in the Banana Wars. He fought in guerrilla wars. He took islands in the Pacific during World War II. He fought in Korea. So you'd think that he might be able to handle just about anything that life threw at him. But like you, he was a parent, and he found that it was just about the hardest thing a person could ever do. When he was just home from Korea, where he'd landed in Incheon and fought in the brutal cold at close quarters, Chesty and his wife had to take their daughter to get her tonsils out. Chesty, who had always been a sweetheart underneath, carried the girl into the operating room. Talking to her softly, he tried to lay her down on the bed and let the nurse prepare her for surgery. But his daughter, scared and overwhelmed, refused to let go. She cried and she screamed and she clung to him until they were eventually able to separate and sedate her. "She will never forgive me, Virginia," he said to his wife when he returned to the waiting room. This was worse than Peleliu. He was only half exaggerating. This thing called parenthood demands more of us than just about anything else in life. It challenges us emotionally, physically, mentally. It tugs on every single one of our heartstrings. You can toughen yourself up for war. You can coolly bet millions of dollars at work, but there's nothing you can do about the gaping soft spot your kids have access to. Nothing can get you quite like they do, because nothing matters to you quite like they do. This is the hardest thing you will ever do. Know it, accept it, be grateful for it. April 15th. Have you seen their perspective?
Have my parents forgotten that they were young once? Apparently, they have. Anne Frank.
We think they're making excuses. We think they're making stuff up. We just want them to go back and sleep in their bed or listen to their coach or get their work done. It's fine, we tell them. Just give it a try. Wear your jacket. It's not that uncomfortable. Do your homework. It's not that difficult. Do you remember reading To Kill a Mockingbird, where Atticus talks about climbing into somebody's skin and walking around in it? Well, have you actually done that? Not with someone you pity or someone you wish to be with, but with someone you aspire to lead and teach and nourish, someone like your own child. Your kid wakes up and comes into your room at night. Try sleeping in their bed. Maybe it really is scary in there. Watch soccer practice. Maybe their coach really is a jerk. How do you think that jacket feels to a kid? Maybe it really is way too hot in there. Did you like doing your homework when you were their age? See their perspective. Crawl inside it. Walk around in it. And take a step back and parent accordingly. April 16th. This solves most problems. Any experienced parent can tell you about the magical panacea called food. Why is your kid screaming? Why are they terrorizing their sibling? Why can't they focus during homeschooling? Why can't they fall asleep? Why is your teenager so moody? The answer is simple. They are hungry. They're hangry. They don't know it. Moms have long carried snacks in their purse for a reason. Because it will solve most problems, soothe most frayed nerves, calm down most difficult situations. Somebody always forgets to eat, so feed them. Ask them if they're hungry. Remind them that they're hungry. Keep a tight meal schedule. Watch what happens. Oh, also, when you're grouchy and frustrated and anxious and short with your spouse and your kids, you might be hangry yourself. In 2014, researchers from Ohio State University found that most fights between couples are because someone is hungry. So like taking a walk or taking 5 deep breaths, grabbing something to eat will probably solve most of your adult problems too. April 17th. Do you know what you look like angry?
It has often been useful for angry people to look in a mirror. The great transformation in themselves has disturbed them. Seneca.
Anger might feel deserved or appropriate, but it almost always looks awful. The next time you're out, try watching for other parents who are getting angry at something their kids are doing. Observe the crowd at your son or daughter's next soccer game. Track the family traveling on vacation at the airport. Pay attention to the group at the big family dinner across from you at the pizza place. It's as close to a look in the mirror as you're likely to get. How do you think you look when you tell your child way too loudly, "Sit down"? I told you already, sit down, when they bounce with too much energy. How do you think you look when you grab them by the arm in frustration and jerk them closer to you in line? Do you think you sound good when threatening to take away some basic privilege of theirs, like a tyrant, because they're not behaving exactly as you like? or when you shout at them to hurry up at the airport. You think you don't look like a monster when, after the argument escalates beyond your ability to manage your words, you slap them across the face. You look terrible. You look as awful and shameful as the people looked when you saw them do the same thing in public to their kids as you tried to avert your gaze. No one looks good angry. Worse still, that image can etch itself into our kid's brain for a long time. April 18th. This is the enemy.
Do not be afraid to get rid of things which distract your attention. Leo Tolstoy.
You are distracted because this weird work email just came in. You're in a bad mood because of something you saw. You're feeling off because of something that somebody said to you. And what happens? Well, your kids get the brunt of it. Or they only get 50% of you at dinner because you're home, but not really home. Preoccupation is the enemy of good parenting. And the worst part, kids can sense it. They are simultaneously sponges and mirrors, and unflattering ones at that. When they act out, make a mess, bite their brother, dye their hair pink, this is what's happening. They sense your energy, and they are responding to it. The sad truth is that most of what we are preoccupied with doesn't even matter. We give the jerk at the office free space in our head. We choose to go on Twitter and doom scroll. We don't need to check our email as much as we do. Worrying about money never solves our money problems. We have to push all of that away so we can be present, so we can be patient, so we can be parents. April 19th. Don't waste these opportunities. Yes, it was annoying, those hours delayed at the airport on the way to your vacation. Yes, it was disappointing that your daughter came home with a terrible report card. Yes, it was scary when you came home with that diagnosis from your doctor. Yes, it was exhausting that you spent another sleepless night with your toddler. But the question, or rather the opportunity, is, did it bring you closer together? It doesn't have to, of course. You can get angry, you can be annoyed, you can be overwhelmed and distracted. Or you can relish the moment, even if they're crying, even if you're disappointed, even if you're crying. You can feel love and gratefulness and happiness instead. Because this is a chance to talk. This is a chance to see them from a different angle. This is a chance to ask questions. This is a chance to spend time together. A crisis, as politicians like to say, is a terrible thing to waste. It is a chance to do things you couldn't do before, things that wouldn't be possible in ordinary circumstances. It's always a chance to get closer, to love more, to understand better. April 20th. It's not fair.
Old people are always very impatient with young ones. Fathers always expect their sons to have their virtues without their faults. Winston Churchill.
We expect so much of our kids. We push them, we prod them, we tell them what to do, we punish them, however lightly, when they fall short. What we lose track of is how impossible our expectations often are for these little humans who lack the decades of life experience that we so absent-mindedly take for granted. There is no blueprint. To assume there is, or worse, to imagine there is and then try to hold your kids to those expectations is wildly unfair. Can we have expectations for our kids? Yes. Can we try to make sure they don't fall into the same traps and develop the same vices as us? It would be criminal if we didn't. But we have to remember that they are like us, for better and for worse. They've lived their whole lives in the same house as us. They've learned from our examples, even the bad ones, especially the bad ones in many cases. They're not going to be perfect. They're going to have our weaknesses, perhaps some of their own too. And to punish them with our unrealistic expectations, even unintentionally, quite literally for the sins of the father, is profoundly unfair. Our job is to love them and be patient with them, not to demand the impossible from them. April 21st. Don't ever, ever do this.
Cato the Elder used to say that a man who beats his wife or child is laying sacrilegious hands on the most sacred thing in the world. Plutarch.
Thankfully, we're at a place where most people don't need to hear this anymore, but unfortunately, some people still do. Maybe they're listening to this book, maybe they're not, but it's worth laying down again. It's worth a reminder of the precious treasure you've been entrusted with. To raise your hand, open or closed, to your spouse or your children is unacceptable. It doesn't matter how angry you are. It doesn't matter who started it. It doesn't matter how many times you told your son. It doesn't matter that your parents used to do it. It doesn't matter that some cultures still accept it. For 2,000 years, we've known deep down that it is wrong. You are here to protect and to serve and to love them. To violate that obligation because you can't control yourself in the moment because you're mad? This is to violate a sacred oath. And once done, it can never be undone. You cannot do it. Ever. April 22nd. Is it good when they're bad? In a New York Times piece, Melinda Winner Moyer, author of the fantastic book, How to Raise Kids Who Aren't Assholes, she asks you to consider perhaps the most counterintuitive idea in all of parenting, that maybe, just maybe, it's not such a big deal when your kids misbehave. Perhaps, she proposes, this is actually a sign of how loved and safe they feel. She writes, think of it this way. When kids are always respectful, complacent, and obedient with adults, it is often because they are afraid of those adults. It's not a coincidence that people who boast about how well-behaved their children are may also be those who throw around phrases like, spare the rod, spoil the child. This is not to say that chaos is a good thing, that no rule should be enforced. It's a reminder that before you write yourself off as a terrible parent because your kid challenged you or because they had a meltdown, consider what it means that they feel comfortable doing that in front of you. It might actually be that they do listen to you, especially when you tell them that you are there for them, that you love them unconditionally, that you want them to think for themselves. It's possible they actually respect you quite deeply, but even more than that, it could be that they trust you more than anyone in the world. April 23rd, don't thrust them away. Of course, kids can be annoying, painfully so. Kids scream in your ears and ruin your clothes with their food and dirt-covered hands. Kids can cut off your air supply as they crawl onto your back for a piggyback ride. And yet you have to absorb all this, even though it hurts, even though you love that shirt, even though you can't breathe, you can't thrust them away. Yes, of course, you have to explain to them what's appropriate and what isn't. You have to protect your own physical well-being. But the point is, they have yet no idea how their actions affect other people. Even teenagers don't fully comprehend the concept of consequences, of cause and effect. Why do you think they drive like crazy, eat like crap, talk all kinds of trash? What they do comprehend is you getting upset, you pulling away. Kids can feel your energy changing, even if they can't put into words what they are sensing or how it makes them feel. And what's most difficult about all of this is that it might very well be that this painful, confusing feeling, as provoked and instinctual as it is, it's that that sticks with them forever. So work on getting control of yourself. Work on toughening yourself up a bit. You can gently unwrap their arms from your throat. You can get a new shirt. You can turn the game around and chase them instead. You can make what was annoying become fun. You can talk to them calmly, correct them, then gently turn the pain into a moment of profound connection. That is entirely up to you. April 24th. What if someone else treated them this way? If you hired a babysitter or a nanny and caught them staring at their phone instead of watching their kids, you'd be livid. If you walked into a room and discovered a teacher or a grandparent or anyone yelling at your kids, you'd be difficult to stop. If you heard someone make a snide remark or tease them or bully them, you'd put an immediate end to it. And yet you do some of those things all of the time. You feel your frustration rising as they refuse to listen, and bam, you grab their arm and yell, stop it right now, right into their little faces. You're ignoring the soccer game. You tune out their incessant attempts to get your attention. Worse, your attention is elsewhere when you're playing in the pool. And for what? For email? For a text? To scroll Twitter? You think you're funny and you like to joke around, but if you saw someone else doing it, you know what you would call that? You would call it bullying. We'd never let anyone else get away with what we rationalize or excuse from our own behavior. That's not to say you're an abusive or bad parent. Not at all. It's just a reminder that your job isn't just to protect your kids from other people. It's to protect your kids from your own bad habits, your own temper, your own flaws too. It's to demand of yourself what you'd expect from anyone to whom you'd entrust your kids' safety. That is to say, you have to demand the best from yourself. No excuses, no double standards. Watch yourself as you'd watch a nanny cam. Trust, but verify, just as you would a new school or a daycare. Ask yourself, would I let anyone get away with what I'm doing right now? April 25th. Delay, delay, delay.
An angry man opens his mouth and shuts his eyes. Cato the Elder.
Seneca said that delay is the greatest remedy for anger, and that's the truth. Delay is the best way to let your mind clear, to make sure that anger doesn't drive you to do something you regret. Anger is an exaggerator. It magnifies the worst in every situation. Anger is an exacerbator, too. It takes a bad situation, it makes it worse with the overreaction it produces in us. Delay will help you make sure that that doesn't happen, that anger doesn't win. The next time you're angry, try taking deep breaths and see if you're still that wound up. It's next to impossible that you can get back there. Now, no one is saying that you can't respond at all. You probably will have to address what has made your blood boil. You will have to say something. Your kids need to learn that lying is not acceptable, that talking back to their mother will not be tolerated, that leaving the stove on could burn the house down. But wait a minute. Take a walk. Put a reminder down to bring it up tomorrow. Deal with it when you come back home from work. Let cooler heads prevail. Make it a teachable moment. Teach them that it's possible to control how you react. April 26th, the moments of leniency matter.
To err is human, to forgive, divine. Alexander Pope.
In Georgia in the mid-1930s, when he was but 10 years old, Jimmy Carter was fishing with his father. As they caught fish, his father attached their growing haul to a trot line that hooked onto Jimmy's belt loop, a point of great pride for the boy. But then, several hours later, Jimmy looked down and realized that the line had broken or become unclipped without him noticing. Frantically, desperately, he dove into the water, searching, hoping, terrified his father would be upset. "What's wrong?" his father asked. "I've lost the fish, Daddy," he said. "All of them?" his father replied. Yes, sir," was all Jimmy could say through his tears. Daddy was rarely patient with foolishness or mistakes, Carter would reflect nearly 80 years later. But then, after a long pause, his father smiled and said, "Let him go, Hot. There's a lot more fish in the river. We'll get them tomorrow." All these years later, it was this moment of patience and kindness and forgiveness that Carter remembered. The fish no longer mattered. In fact, they never did matter. What mattered was that his father knew what Jimmy needed in that moment. But what about you? Do you understand the power of leniency and tolerance? Can you let things go? Can you control your temper and frustrations? Do you know when it's time to push, and when it's time to pull them close to you? April 27th. You're the voice in their heads.
The power broker in your life is the voice that no one hears. How well you revisit the tone and content of your private voice is what determines the quality of your life. Dr. Jim Lehrer.
You're just trying to get them to behave, to listen to you, to stop hitting their sister, to take school seriously, to do whatever. So you speak firmly, even harshly. You're tired. You've had this conversation 1,000 times, and you're not as kind as you could be. Maybe you try to make a joke out of it to soften the delivery of your honest opinion about what they're doing, except the joke hits a soft spot and it cuts too close to the bone. You know what you're doing, really, in these moments? You're cementing a very specific voice in their heads. Everything we say, every interaction we have with our kids is shaping them. How we speak to them informs how they will speak to themselves. If you want proof of this, think about all the complexes and scripts you have picked up from your parents. Maybe things you're working on in therapy right now, decades later. So while you can, before it's too late, catch yourself. Think about how you can be an ancestor instead of a ghost. Make this interaction a kind one, a patient one, a friendly one. Speak to them the way you'd want them to speak to themselves, because it's not a matter of how they will internalize the things they heard growing up. It's a matter of what they will internalize. Put a good voice in their heads so they might remember the good stuff. April 28th. Do you really care?
A key point to bear in mind, you're better off not giving the small things more time than they deserve. Marcus Aurelius.
It seems like it's really important to you that the door not be slammed, that the chores have been done a certain way, that everything be put away immediately, that feet go on the ground, not on the furniture. But the truth is, you don't actually care about these things themselves. You don't. If you had to choose between your kids having fond memories and you having clean walls, you'd choose your kids having fun. If you had to choose between slightly lower grades and better self-worth, you'd choose their self-worth. If you had to choose between just about anything and your kids' safety, happiness, or self-image, you'd never choose the other stuff. Yet here you are arguing about it again, choosing to die on some stupid hill, choosing to protect a piece of sheetrock that, admit it, you don't actually care about. What you really care about, what those rules represent, is obedience and control. What you're really worried about, and hence the fixation, is the deep-seated anxiety you might be screwing them up. Relax. Let this stuff go. Seriously, just let it go. You won't regret it. April 29th. How long can you go?
Kind people are never involved in arguments, and those who like to argue are never kind. Lao Tzu.
At the end of it, you'll wish you fought less with your kids. You wish you made less of an issue, so many things. Nobody looks back on their lives or their kids' lives and thinks, I'm so glad we got into all those arguments. I'm glad I was so hard on them. I'm glad they finally learned all the rules. You know this. Okay, so today, how long can you go? How long can you go without chiding your kids about this or that, without making remarks about your teenager's choices, without reminding your young one to stop dragging their feet, leaning on the table, leaving their things laying about? See if you can make the majority of your interactions uncritical. That doesn't mean you have to be disingenuously positive about them, only that you stop bothering them about so much piddly crap. None of that stuff matters now, as much as you might try to convince them and yourself otherwise. It definitely won't matter years from now when you're all reflecting on your lives together. So dial back the criticism. Remember, you don't have to have an opinion about everything. If you can keep some of that stuff in your back pocket, you'll both be happier for it. April 30th. Who gets your patience? The father of former Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, was a pastor in East Germany. He was beloved by his flock. He forged a deep bond with them over many years. But at home, things were a little different. At home, he was stern and impatient. What really made me angry as a child was his way of showing so much understanding for everyone else, his daughter would reflect. But if we children did something wrong, his reaction was completely different. Clearly, her father was capable of being understanding and kind. He did it all the time as part of his job, every day. But maybe that was part of the problem. He'd used up all his patience at work and had none left for his family when he got home. Or maybe he held himself to a different standard professionally than personally because it wasn't public. Or maybe he made the mistake that many of us do, forgetting that our children are little people with the same problems as everyone else, just at a different size. And because of that, we sometimes fail to treat them with the appropriate level of dignity, respect, and compassion. You don't yell at a colleague just because they left the door open. You don't punish one of your players for wanting more of your attention and counsel. And yet children all over the world throughout all time can speak to relationships where that was the exact kind of treatment they received from their parents who are at the end of their ropes and had run out of patience. Be kind to your family. Make sure they get the same patience and understanding as everyone else. Actually, scratch that. Make sure they get more. Because long after you've left this job or stopped coaching that team, they will still be your kids. May. Character is fate. Lessons in right and wrong. May 1st. This predicts everything.
Character is fate. Heraclitus.
Who a person is determines what will happen and what they can do. It's true in sports, it's true in politics, it's true in business. No matter how talented a person is, how great the incentives, how great the system around them, in the end, character is everything. It can't be hidden. It can't be compensated for. It comes out. Your job as a parent, as you seek to create a better world for your kids and raise them to be good in the world, is to value character, to teach it to them, to model it for them, to reward it when you see it in them. Yes, you want them to be smart. Yes, you want them to be ambitious. Yes, you want them to be creative and hardworking. But these traits are worthless if not yoked behind good character. We are seeing the costs of ignoring that in every facet of life right now. We need to fix it, and the fix starts at home. May 2nd, your character builds theirs. The image of the black Escalade crashed into the tree was everywhere. Then the women began to come forward, first one, then another, and then still more. And eventually he admitted it. Tiger Woods confessed to extramarital infidelity with more than 120 women. It was news to almost everyone, but those who knew him were not surprised, and those who knew him well weren't surprised at all. Tiger Woods' biographers quote the well-worn cliches, like father, like son, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. For years, when Earl Woods had took his son Tiger to golf tournaments around the country, he didn't make an effort to camouflage his vices. Women came and went from hotel rooms. He'd stop at convenience stores and come out with paper bags holding 40-ounce bottles of liquor. He'd ask waitresses to join him for a cigarette. The gambling, the waitresses, the infidelity, it wasn't out of character for Tiger. It was his character, or rather, it was the character traits taught by his father. He was built from the blueprint drawn from his father Earl's example. The apple didn't fall far from the tree because the tree made the apple. May 3rd, nourish this wonderful trait. The primary and most important influence on Queen Victoria was not her mother, but her beloved governess, who later became an advisor and friend. And it was from this governess that Victoria got the backbone that made her one of England's great queens, one who ruled for some 63 years, more than 40 of them by herself. And as that governess said with trademark modesty, "I have, to be sure, not created, but nourished in the princess one quality, which is to test, consider, and to stand firmly by that which the princess finds right and good." You have a lot of responsibilities as a parent, but none of them trump this one. Yes, you want your kids to be smart. Yes, you want them to be helpful and healthy. You want them to do well in school, but none of that will be possible without having nourished this ability, the one that Victoria was shown how to cultivate. So do it. Do it every day. May 4th. You have to teach your kid these four virtues.
If at some point in your life, you should come across anything better than justice, truth, self-control, courage, it must be an extraordinary thing indeed. Marcus Aurelius.
Aristotle worshipped them, the Christians and the Stoics too. In the West, we call them the cardinal virtues from the Latin word cardo, which means hinge. These are the virtues upon which the good life hinges. These are the virtues that every parent is obligated to teach their children. Courage, to stand up, to charge ahead, to not be afraid or timid in life. Moderation, to know balance, to be in control of oneself, to avoid excess or extremes. Justice, to do the right thing, to care for others, to do your duty. Wisdom, to learn, to study, to keep an open mind. These are the four essential tenets for living. As a parent, you must worship these virtues and raise kids who do the same. You have to model these virtues and teach them by example and by instruction how they can too. Their life and the future hinges on it. May 5th, everything you do is teaching them.
Preach the gospel at all times. Use words if necessary. Francis of Assisi.
As a young man, the champion boxer and civil rights activist Floyd Patterson was all trouble. He stole, he skipped school, he got into fights. He once tragically took a picture of himself and scratched out the eyes looking back at him because he didn't like himself. And so finally, the authorities sent him away. It could have been another sad chapter in a sad life. Instead, Patterson was lucky enough to be sent away to a boys' commune in upstate New York. There, under the guidance of a kind and unconventional psychologist, Patterson's world was changed. For the first time he was seen, he was more than reformed in the language of the American prison system. He was loved. And as that doctor explained the philosophy, punishment teaches the child only how to punish. Scolding teaches him how to scold. By showing him that we understand, we teach him to understand. By helping, we teach him to help. He learns cooperation by cooperating. Most likely, your children have not found themselves in such serious trouble. Hopefully, they are not too far gone, as most of the people around Floyd felt that he was. But regardless, the lesson is the same. In everything we do with and to and around our kids, we are teaching them. Even when we mean well, even when they are screwing up, we are teaching, often the opposite of what we would like to show them. May 6th, teach them to sweep the sheds. The New Zealand All Blacks are the most successful rugby franchise of all time. They have a legacy that rivals the great teams in nearly every sport, from the San Antonio Spurs to the New England Patriots to the U.S. national women's soccer team. How have they done this? By being tough, of course, by being extremely talented, obviously. But there is a lesser known and counterintuitive element to their success as well. They clean up after themselves. In his book, Legacy, James Kerr portrays the team tidying up the locker room after a game, sweeping the sheds, he writes, doing it properly so no one else has to, because no one looks after the All Blacks. The All Blacks look after themselves. If you want your kids to clean up after themselves, you have to teach them why it matters. If you want them to look after themselves, you have to teach them to find pride and satisfaction in that. If you want them to sweep the sheds, you have to teach them that it isn't just a chore. It is a statement of priority, a statement of character and commitment and self-sufficiency, an illustration of who you are. How we do anything is how we do everything. It's a lesson that parents have to pass along to their kids. Leaving a mess isn't just a mess. It shows that you are a mess. May 7th. Don't give them an ego. You love your kids more than anything. You think they're God's gift, which they are to you. You want them to know how you feel about them. You feel bad when they feel bad about themselves. These are all perfectly healthy and laudable feelings. But at the same time, we have to make sure we're not puffing up their ego with our endless praise. We have to manage our natural bias towards their virtues and limit our blindness to their vices. As Seneca wrote, this requires speaking honestly with kindness and holding them accountable for their actions, even if it pains us. As he explains, flattery must be kept well out of the way of children. Let a child hear the truth and sometimes fear it. Let him always reverence it. Let him rise in the presence of his elders. Let him obtain nothing by flying into a passion. Let him be given when he is quiet what was refused him when he cried for it. Let him behold but not make use of his father's wealth. Let him be reproved for what he does wrong. Seneca knew this balance wasn't easy. It isn't for any parent. But if our goal is to raise well-adjusted, self-aware kids, we'll have to work for it. Even if our instinct is to rush over and tell them that they're the greatest, most specialist little kid there ever was. May 8th. Punishment should make them better.
To punish others is like putting more wood in the fire. Every crime already has punishment in itself, and it is more cruel and more just than the punishment created by people. Leo Tolstoy.
Randall Stutman is asked a lot about parenting by the CEOs and executives with whom he works as a leadership coach. We already know his admonition about making fast transitions from work and home, but he has another piece of advice for high-powered leaders who also want to be great parents. Punishment, he said, should make them better. It's pretty fitting advice coming from a coach, too. Think about it. A basketball coach who is disappointed in someone's effort makes them do sprints or push-ups. It's not fun, and it makes the kid stronger. A football player who doesn't make their GPA has to go to extra study sessions. An athlete who gets in trouble off the court might have to do community service or write an apology letter. These are more than just simple deterrents. They're punishments that make the transgressors better, both as people and as players. When you get upset when you catch your kids doing something they're not supposed to do, make sure you don't punish them from a place of heightened emotion, whether that's anger or fear or shame. Take a minute, come up with a punishment that makes them better, something they wouldn't choose to do, but is good for them. Vocab drills, memorizing state capitals, volunteering somewhere, picking up trash, painting the house. They won't like it, but one day they might actually thank you for it. May 9th. Too busy to be bad. Harry Truman was once asked if he ever got in trouble as a kid. Very, very seldom. He said, I was too busy. I told you I'd read all 3,000 books in the library by the time I was 14 years old. Were there any troublemakers in your neighborhood or at school, he was asked. We had boys who were terrible, he said, but I was too busy reading books to be bad. The September chapter of The Daily Dad is going to be filled with the benefits of raising a reader, but Truman gives us a great one to add here in May. Readers very, very seldom get in trouble. They're too busy. They already live in a world of high stakes, that of history, of great novels, of epic stories. Why do they need to go around creating drama and problems in the real world? Of course, kids get in trouble for a lot of reasons, but not having anything better to do is one you can solve right now. Introduce them to the world of books, challenge them, incentivize them to read, let them fall in love with those worlds and live there as much as they want. It'll cause a lot less trouble for both of you. May 10th, remember what success looks like. The Bible puts forth a pretty good definition of an actual successful life. An elder must be blameless, faithful to his wife, a man whose children are trustworthy, and not open to the charge of being wild and disobedient. We can strip the gender out of this, and it's still true. Our job is to live an honorable life, treat our spouse well and respect our marriage, teach our children to be honest and reliable, and refrain from spoiling them. If you can be successful or famous or respected at your chosen craft above all that, fantastic. But just remember, no amount of worldly gains will matter, especially at the end of your life, if you have failed at being a parent to those with whom you would most love to share those gains. May 11th. Are you the good guys? That's what the boy asks his father in Cormac McCarthy's The Road. Are we still the good guys? It's the boy's sweetness, his insistence on doing the right and kind thing despite the darkness of the world that keeps the father from spiraling into despair and cruelty. Are you the good guys? Or have you curdled along with your political party? Have you been corrupted by your industry? Have you grown callous and indifferent with all the responsibilities and stresses of life? Are you too busy worrying about your mortgage and your golf game to care about other people? Are you too far down the road to change, to question, and reflect, to see things from a new perspective? The good news is that you have a boy like that in your own life. Your kids are a wonderful source of innocence and purity. They see things with fresh eyes. They are not yet jaded. They are also a kind of warrant. Why should you change? Why should you be one of the good guys? For them. Give them hope. Give them a model. Be one of the good guys. May 12th. What matters more than results? The actress Tracy Ellis Ross has a famous, successful mother in the multiple Grammy Award winner and Motown legend, Diana Ross. You might think that someone that successful would care a lot about success. The driven parent drives their children to get good grades, to win games, to be the strongest, the prettiest, or the most popular, to follow in their footsteps. Their high standards extend right down through the college their kids go to or the profession they pursue. But Tracy got lucky. Her mom did it right. Most parents would ask their kids, "How are your grades? Did you win? Are you number one in your class?" she said. But after school, Diana Ross would ask, "Did you do your best? How do you feel about it, Tracy?" And Tracy, who amid some fits and starts went on to become a very accomplished actress, would explain that her mother's emphasis taught her an essential perspective shift. One that taught her how to navigate a life through how it feels to you as opposed to how it looks to everyone else. What matters more than your kids' grades in school is the priorities they pick up and the values they absorb. So that's the question. Are you teaching them that test scores matter or that learning counts? Are you teaching them that success is winning arbitrary competitions, or is it in becoming the best version of themselves? Results don't matter, not the obvious ones anyway. What counts is the person your kids are shaping themselves into and the things you do along the way to help them. May 13th. Ask them this question every day.
Wherever there is a human being, there is an opportunity for kindness. Seneca.
We're always asking our kids questions. How was school? How did baseball practice go? Did you stay out of trouble? What did your teacher say about your math grade? Did you have fun with your friends? We ask these questions because we want to have something to talk about. We ask these questions because we're concerned. We ask these questions because the answers matter to us. And our kids realize this. They are smart enough to understand that these questions are a reflection of their parents' values, of how the world measures a person and determines what success looks like. Which is why it's so important that we go out of our way to ask questions that reinforce what's actually important in life, that we don't just consider it insignificant small talk, because it's not. The way that Diana Ross asked Tracy Ellis Ross about her day is a great example. But here's another. Instead of asking your kids if they behaved well or performed well or even if they have fun, be sure to check in about whether they did something kind. Ask them every day, what good turn did you do today? What was something you did for someone else? Who did you help? Think of the message this sends. Think of how it makes them think about their own day, to review their own actions through the lens of empathy, how their actions affect others. Think of the priorities it sets through your monitoring, that their parents are on top of not how many answers they got right, but how many things they did right. And think about how much better the world would be if everyone thought this way, if everyone was raised this way. May 14th, compete on this.
Compete with yourself and root for everybody else. Candace Millard.
We all find ourselves in competition with other parents. Maybe we see how our car compares with everyone else's at school drop-off, or we dress up really fancy for a school fundraiser, hoping to turn heads. Very quickly, this kind of competition can transfer to our kids. We want to make sure that they have the same gadgets as their peers. We can look at what colleges they get into compared with their friends, or we can start to push them to be valedictorian or captain of the baseball team or president of the student council. And this is not just a superficial competition, but a stupid and possibly destructive one, as those Varsity Blues parents currently serving prison sentences should remind us. Not just because it's a competition we'll inevitably lose. There will always be someone richer, someone hotter, someone whose kids are more naturally gifted. But it's also stupid because it can rub off on our kids in the worst way. If you're going to compete with anyone, we should tell our kids, compete with yourself to be the best version of yourself. Compete over things you actually control. Make no mistake. We should take that advice ourselves. Compete with yourself to be more present, to be kinder, to have more fun with your kids, to beat what you got from your own parents. Focus on the stuff that's up to you that can be an example for your kids as they grow into the people you want them to become. May 15th, teach them empathy. One of the wonderful benefits of reading fiction, studies show, is that it helps cultivate empathy. By reading and experiencing the interior lives of characters on the page, we are reminded that not everyone thinks and acts like we do. We are reminded that not everyone has been as lucky as we have been. It also happens that fiction can teach us this empathy by way of specific advice and admonition. Perhaps you remember this opening line from The Great Gatsby. In my younger and more vulnerable years, my father gave me some advice that I have been turning over in my mind ever since, F. Scott Fitzgerald writes. Whenever you feel like criticizing anyone, he told me, just remember that all the people in this world haven't had the advantages that you have had. We need our kids to understand this, and that's why they have to read The Great Gatsby and every other great novel. It's also something we have to explicitly remind them, the way that Nick Carraway's father did in the book. Most importantly, it's something we have to model ourselves. May 16th, what we do ripples through.
It is from numberless diverse acts of courage that human history is thus shaped. Each time a man stands up for an ideal, or acts to improve the lot of others, or strikes out against injustice, he sends forth a tiny ripple of hope, and crossing each other from a million different centers of energy and daring those ripples, build a current which can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance. Robert F. Kennedy.
In the beautiful children's book, Each Kindness, Jacqueline Woodson tells the story of a young girl named Chloe who, in the casual way that kids often do, treats a classmate cruelly. She is moved to change one day when the teacher demonstrates the way that water ripples when a stone is dropped into it. So it goes with kindness, the teacher explains. When we do something nice for someone, it ripples through their lives and into the world, radiating goodness outward. Chloe is inspired by this, but it's too late. The girl she was cruel to has moved away. And now when she throws a rock into the pond near her house, all she can think of are the lost opportunities she had to improve someone's life, to make their day brighter. And this is something we must teach our kids. Moreover, we must demonstrate it to our kids by treating them well. By showing them compassion and empathy and unconditional love, we help not only them, but everyone they encounter. And we can take to heart knowing that this kindness, big and small, will ripple through their lives after they've moved out, after they've grown up, after we're long gone. May 17th, teach them to give it their all. Rudyard Kipling's beautiful poem, If, which was written as advice for Kipling's son, is about toughness and virtue, honor and duty. There's one line that doesn't get as much attention. Maybe that's because it's a bit confusing. It reads, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run. Kipling is talking about the importance of giving your all to something, physical and otherwise. There's an expression in sports about playing through the whistle. In boxing and martial arts, you punch through the opponent until you hear the bell. In baseball, you swing through the ball. In running, they talk about running through the finish line. It's about completing the action, giving 100%, playing the right way. And this is an important lesson to teach our kids. We don't stop at the finish line. We give our all to something. We concentrate on a single task till it's done or until the clock runs out. We fill that unforgiving minute. It's the proper way to play and to live. May 18th, teach them to do the right thing.
Just that you do the right thing. The rest doesn't matter. Marcus Aurelius.
In the beautiful and hilarious novel, A Man Called Ove, a young Ove is working at the same rail yard as his father. He is cleaning a car with another worker, Tom, when they find a briefcase left by a passenger. Instinctively, Tom goes to steal it. Ove is surprised. A few seconds later, he finds and picks up a wallet left by a different passenger. Just then, Ove's father walks in and he asks Ove what he wants to do with the wallet. Ove suggests that they return it to the lost and found, where it is quickly claimed by the woman who lost it. Not many people have ever handed in this much money, the woman says. Well, Ove's father replies, many people don't have any decency either. Later that evening, Ove asks his father why he didn't tell management about the briefcase that Tom had stolen. His father shakes his head and replies, we're not the sort of people who tell tales about what others do. In both instances, Ove's father is showing his boy what decency looks like. Decency is about what you do. It's not a standard you hold others to. Decency is what you do with the money you find. It's how you raise your kids. It's not something you wield. It's not something you gossip about. It's something you embody and embrace. May 19th. Teach them to be bigger. A 10-year-old Jim Lawson was walking down the street when he passed a car, and a small child looked at him and called him the N-word. Stunned by the hate and the meanness of it, Lawson reached into the car and slapped the boy in the face. When his mother found out about this, she was understandably worried. In the then segregated and racist South, the actions of a young black boy could so easily lead to something terrible and tragic at the hands of awful and unaccountable adults. But more than that, she wanted her son not to be defined by or changed by the hate of the world around him. What good did that do, Jimmy? His mother asked him. We all love you, Jimmy, she said, and God loves you. And we all believe in you and how good and intelligent you are. We have a good life and you are going to have a good life. And with all that love, what harm does that stupid insult do? It's nothing, Jimmy, she said. It's empty, just ignorant words from an ignorant child who is gone from your life the moment it was said. It was a life-changing exchange. It put Jim Larson onto his world-changing path of nonviolence. He would later organize the first sit-ins in Nashville in the 1960s. It helped him realize that he was above the horrible things that other people said and did, and that what mattered was what he said and did. What mattered was responding with kindness and love. What mattered was knowing that he was good and that he was loved and that nothing anyone else thought could change that. Lawson's parents gave him the gift of teaching him that he was bigger than the small people who lived around him, that he could be the bigger person and do bigger things. But now, here today, can you do the same thing for your children? May 20th. Don't just assume it will all work out. In Meditations, Marcus Aurelius takes a moment to remind himself of the malice and cunning and hypocrisy that power produces, and the peculiar ruthlessness often shown by people from good families. Even though you're well-educated, even though you've done well for your family, you're not some monster. There's no guarantees that you will pass these laudable traits down to your kids. Life is full of temptations, full of bad habits and bad influences that are easy to fall prey to. Look at Marcus Aurelius's own children. Marcus and his wife were calm and wise, and still something went wrong with his son and heir Commodus, who was deranged and a terror for the empire, exactly as bad as Commodus in the movie Gladiator, or maybe worse. The point of this is, just because you're successful, just because you can pay to send your kids to the right schools, just because you showed up more than your own parents, it doesn't mean you're out of the woods. This is a hard job we're committed to. The stakes are high. The margin for error is low. Kids don't just turn out as good people. They're made that way. Molded, guided by ancestors, taught by example, buoyed by the constancy of parental presence. You must provide all of this. You cannot slack. You cannot assume it will handle itself. They need you. May 21st. And what did you do? In the 1920s, long before he was a poet, before he was a conscientious objector, before he had kids of his own, William Stafford was just a kid living in an era when bullying and racism and all sorts of cruelty existed out in the open. One day, young William came home and reported to his parents that two young black kids were being taunted at school. His parents had one question for him. And what did you do, Billy? Notice that the elder Staffords didn't dismiss what was happening as not their kid, nor did they rush to the phone to call his teachers. They did not yell. They did not make assumptions. They used the incident as an opportunity to emphasize a core life teaching. We are responsible for each other. We cannot sit on the sidelines when bad things happen in front of us. One can imagine that they were hoping to hear an answer that revealed their son had absorbed these lessons that they had been trying to teach in their home his whole life. Like any good parent, their question was a test to see if they understood how virtue and duty and kindness and human decency must be practiced to be perfected. And we can only imagine when they heard his reply, "I went and stood by them."